Thank you for listening to the Faith Radio Mornings podcast. Enjoy the conversation.
Start your day connecting faith to life with Faith Radio Mornings.
Let it rise.
Good morning. 4 minutes after the hour, Bill Arnold here with you today on this beautiful day. It appears nice anyway, outside. Here in the Twin Cities, it's going to be a near perfect day. It is May 31st. Tomorrow is June 1 already. Cannot believe it. June 1. Summer begins. That's always, in my mind, the official start of summer. Anyway, we can only focus our minds on a limited amount of things, and the onslaught of media never rests. So I hope here at Faith Radio we can bring you information and do it with perspective of faith and hope and clarity. This is what I always pray for as we spend the mornings together, as we race to get our day started. You know, yesterday I downloaded the prayercast.com app so I can be encouraged to pray during Ramadan, which is a way to actively and intentionally pray for the lost and persecuted Christians during Ramadan. I figured I was the first on my block to download the app, so I tested my theory, and I went door to door in my neighborhood. And it turns out I was the first on my block to download the app, and it was also suggested to me to stay off lawns. So anyway, in Ephesians 4:32, it says, "Be kind and compassionate to one another, forgiving each other just as Christ has forgiven you." So we need to be kind and compassionate to one another. As I was reading my prayer for the day on PrayerCast, praying for the people of Somalia today, praying for the believing minority who suffer great persecution and martyrdom, pray for courage and strength for those who are boldly sharing their faith, and pray for safe fellowship and encouragement for many isolated believers. Sunni Islam is the official religion of the very unstable nation of Somalia, with really no apparent permanent government. Somalia functions under the temporary leadership of the Union of Islamic Courts, which serves as a transitional authority. The East African nation, located on the Gulf of Aden and the Indian Ocean, is susceptible to droughts and dust storms in the summer and floods during the rainy season. Somalia has the seventh highest birth rate in the world, accompanied by the second highest maternal mortality rate and the fourth highest infant mortality rate. So it's a troubled area, and we have lots to pray for during this time as they are going through lots of persecution, and we need to pray for the many lost people and the people who are sharing their faith there. It is a 99.7% Muslim population and 0.3% Christian. So there you go. That is to be prayed for. All right, we've got a great, great show this morning. We've got Karen Swanson coming up. We're going to talk about prison reform and how are we doing in that department. She is on the studio line. We're going to take a very short break. And when we come back, we're going to find out exactly her perspective on this, which is, to me, extremely interesting because of my experience as well doing prison ministry. So it is 7 minutes after the hour. We'll be right back. Good morning. 8 minutes after the hour, Karen Swanson is she is the director of Institute for Prison Ministries at the Billy Graham Center for Evangelism at Wheaton College. And Karen, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, you bet. I have a huge interest in your topic. I've been involved in a lot of prison ministry myself. I've been in over 80 prisons across the country.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. What did you do when you were in the prison?
Well, I was part of Starting Line, which was...
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
I'm familiar with that.
Yeah, so I did Starting Line for 10 years and was in a lot of prisons, anywhere
okay.
from pre-release centers to death row. So
okay.
I've seen a lot of it, and it's been...
Right.
I'm very interested to get your perspective. The United States arrests about 3,000 people, what is it, a day?
I'm not sure. There's probably about 12,000 that go through the system every year.
Oh, my goodness. So
yeah.
We've got a lot of people we are arresting and incarcerating.
Right. Yeah.
So what are we doing in terms of fixing the justice system, and are we really helping people by putting them behind bars the way we are, the rate at which we're putting them behind bars?
Right. So the U.S. over-incarcerates is sometimes termed the mass incarceration. And what we found, though, is that prison is not helping because up to two-thirds recidivate or return to prison after they get out, and some studies show about half return. So we're not really dealing with the problem. We're just, you know, kind of warehousing people as opposed to dealing with, you know, how did they get there in the first place.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of times prison is not really designed to rehabilitate anybody. It's designed to punish them. And as inmates
right.
go into the system, they realize the first thing they have to do is survive. And they're going to do whatever
right.
it takes to survive, when many of them should, like, say, maybe get their GED or do something constructive. What they're concerned about is making it inside.
Right, exactly. And the number of programs that are offered are not, you know, there's often a waiting list, or there's not enough programs for people who want programs to make the change. Plus, there's different kinds of people who are locked up behind bars. So not everybody is the same.
Oh, say more about that, because I couldn't agree more.
So you have some people who are what you might call career criminals who have no desire to change. And then you might have some that are very manipulative, who are maybe violent. And then you have others who have life management issues.
Mm-hmm.
They, you know, just struggle to get by. And then you have, they have faulty thinking that leads to their criminal behavior. And then you have, women have a different pathway than men. Researcher found recently that there's just been a lot of trauma in the lives of people who are behind bars.
Mm-hmm.
And that contributes to drug addiction as well as mental illness. And so that then may lead to a criminal behavior to support the addiction. So it's very complicated. There's no simple answers, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. There was a judge, Dennis Shaleen, coined the term NORP, which is an acronym for Normal, Ordinary, Responsible Person, who is self-reliant,
right.
understands responsibility, and knows what is morally right. A lot of inmates don't really come out of that mold, do they?
Right. Now, I would say the majority, you know, don't come out of that mold.
They come up from a very dysfunctional family, and
right.
they maybe never saw parents go to work regularly. Maybe
right.
they saw drug use in their own home as a child and as a kid. And what's
Or maybe introduced to drugs by their parents.
Right. Yeah, where the dad or the mom introduces them to smoking marijuana when they're 12 or 13. And
right.
then
yeah.
all of a sudden when the kid turns 18, he teaches the dad how to smoke meth. It's just crazy.
Right. Yeah. Right. Exactly.
And I've seen so many people, so many men in particular, who have no sense of consequences, because when they're on their drug run, they simply don't care what the consequences
right.
might be. So you can threaten
right.
them with more prison time, but they go, whatever.
Right, yeah. So prison time is viewed sometimes just as punishment to endure.
Mm-hmm.
So you just, you know, do what you need to do, and then you get back out, and you, as one guy would say, rip and run. And then, or it's, you know, viewed as part of the business. If you're, you know, selling drugs, it's like, well, you know, it's just part of the business, is doing a little bit of time. So.
And they even refer to it very casually by saying things like, well, I have to go sit for 4 years.
Yeah,
I go,
right.
what? Sit for 4 years? You mean you're going to prison? I don't know how that's
right.
sitting,
or,
you know. That's
right.
4 years
or I
of
heard,
your life.
Well, one guy said it's a state-paid vacation.
Yes, yes. So let's talk about mandatory minimums, because that usually creates lots of issues, and it shouldn't be coming down from the federal government, should it?
Right. And those mandatory minimums, though, I think are affect the federal prisoners, because, you know, really in the U.S. you get, you know, every state has its own justice system and laws, and then every county enforces their laws. So there's all different kinds of systems, and there's not just one system. But the federal government gets oftentimes quoted because they're national, but most of their laws only affect federal prisoners. But mandatory minimums, right, takes away some of the options the judges have as far as sentencing and not considering maybe some of the circumstances or the person who is being, who's in front of them.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Now, talk about the current criminal justice system, and is it just? Does it treat criminals the same way, or people who have been arrested?
Right. So I think that, and this is where I feel like as a church or as a Christians that we are called to speak up for justice. That's pretty clear in the Bible that that's important to God and should be important to us. And so I think the criminal justice system favors those who are wealthy, and it is also racially biased.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, if you look at just the research, it supports both of those issues. But, like, take, for example, somebody who is arrested, who's wealthy, let's say they're charged with murder, but they can afford the bail, so they're out. So
mm-hmm.
They're not even viewed as a criminal because they're not behind bars. But someone who has a petty theft, but they can't afford the $200 bail, they're behind bars. And they're the ones that are, you know, they lose their job, they lose their house because they, you know, don't have a job, they lose their car. So they begin to lose everything they have just because they're poor.
Mm-hmm.
They can't afford that bail. And they're then also viewed as a criminal because they're the ones that are behind bars.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a double system, definitely favors the wealthy, as well as wealthy can hire a private attorney and has more money to do investigation and testing and things that would support their case.
Mm-hmm. I've been to court many, many times with guys that were facing time, and they had a public defender. And God bless the work of these public defenders. They're called to do what they're doing, but they are absolutely overloaded and sometimes don't have much conversation with their client until day before or day of.
Right, exactly.
And you really wonder how thorough they can be in examining the evidence and trying to get the best outcome for their client.
Right. Right, and that's where also the majority, I think like 97% of all cases are resolved through plea bargains
mm-hmm.
as opposed to going to trial.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Karen, I'm going to take a little break. When we come back, I want to talk more about the justice system and what you've got, your facts and findings. We'll take a short break and be right back. Good morning, 20 minutes after the hour. So glad you're with us today. Bill Arnold here talking to Dr. Karen Swanson, who's the Director of Institute for Prison Ministries at the Billy Graham Center for Evangelism in Wheaton College. When Billy Graham did his crusade here in 96 in Minneapolis, I did the prison ministry arm of his crusade, because when he comes to town, he wants to evangelize everyone, including the incarcerated folks here in the state. And we did all of the 8 facilities here in Minnesota, and it was very powerful. People behind bars, I think incarceration and the Department of Corrections is one of the greatest evangelical tools out there, because when 3 sets of doors slam and the bars close behind you, you hear that little voice in your head. Many say they hear the voice saying, "Do I have your attention now?" And people get an opportunity for the first time. And you make a great point in an article that you wrote for Christianity Today about rehabilitation, which doesn't really happen in prison. Yeah, I think you said it's like putting a kid in a shed because he or she can't swim, and then expecting that child to be able to swim when she's released without any time in the water.
Right. Yeah. And I think, you know, too, that, you know, even rehabilitation, some people have never been habilitated in the first place.
Right.
So they, because they've grown up in this moral vacuum and these faulty thinking, and, you know, so it's a whole different world than what the NORPs grew up in.
Right.
So
remind
so
people what the NORPs are.
I'm sorry, what?
Remind people what the NORPs are.
Sure, yeah. So the NORPs are the normal, ordinary, responsible people who, you know, have moral, you know, behavior. They obey the laws. They learn from their mistakes. They're responsible. They're reliable. They can foresee consequences. They're deterred by punishment. And so that's, and we're the ones that make the laws oftentimes and are voting. And so that's why we we make these tough on crime laws kind of thing. So like you said, you know, the person in the shed is like, well, they didn't learn after the first time, then let's lock them up longer because obviously they didn't care or they didn't learn, and so let's extend their time being locked up.
Mm-hmm.
So punishment is sort of, because we learn by punishment, so we expect others to learn by punishment as well.
Right. And many have an inability to thrive. I've seldom seen an inmate that can really come out and thrive in society for some of the reasons you just explained, that the upbringing was very dysfunctional, and they step
right
back into a life that's still filled with dysfunction, and they've got felonies on their records, and they've done
right
wrong, and they've asked for forgiveness, and they've tried to rehabilitate their life, but they're still way behind the eight ball.
Right, exactly. And trauma plays a big part of it as well. As so, you know, the trauma, they're still carrying that, the effects of that, and that interferes with life as well.
Mm-hmm. And really, many inmates have never really known what it's like to have a really good friend.
Right.
And that's where Prison Fellowship and any prison ministry can have a huge impact in an inmate's life, because they've had friendships that have been so temporary, whether they've been friendships that they had when they were very young that were dysfunctional, or they grew into friendships that were part of a gang or of an activity that uses drugs or alcohol, and those are all temporary relationships, and they don't even know what a real true friend is, do they?
Right. No, they don't. And so, yeah, their view of people is kind of like, well, you know, they either have your back or you have theirs, and it's a temporary thing. It's more like a possession than a relationship. And so that's why one of the factors that has been found to work is having mentors or life coaches who come alongside people who invest in the person and have helping them in that relationship. As well as, research has also found that people who come to Christ while in prison, that they're more likely to stay with Christ after they get out, is if they get connected to a faith community. So otherwise, oftentimes they fall away from their faith.
Mm-hmm. Karen, talk to the person listening that says, you know what, that might be something I could do, but it sounds scary to me.
Right. So actually, we just created a life coaching program for walking alongside adults as they transition back into society. And so we've created some online training that people could go through to say, you know, is this something I could do? And it's life on life, and it's what God has called us to do as far as, you know, investing in other people and loving other people and discipling others or witnessing to others and being a role model. So we have that training available on our online, so people could go through that and say, oh, I could do this, or, you know, and then there's probably opportunities in their area, or their church could get connected in that way. So maybe they don't want to go inside a facility. And actually, the need is so much more on the outside for people in reentry than even going inside a prison facility.
Mm-hmm. But the need is great, and there are so many opportunities to meet someone at a time of dire need and brokenness, and to speak truth into their life and to give them a chance to literally just be discipled in God's Word. And,
right,
you know, it can even be something as innocent as, you know, having a pen pal in prison.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah. I'm a pen pal with a fairly famous incarcerated person. I won't mention his name, but he's extremely well-known, killed someone very famous, and
uh-huh,
he absolutely just loves getting letters, and you speak
right
God's truth into the letters, and he actually sends me back letters that have that same kind of powerful truth of God in it, because he's on fire for Jesus. So it's actually kind of a nice relationship.
Right. And, I mean, letters are a lifeline for people who are incarcerated, because oftentimes their visitors dwindle over the years, and the last person to come visit is their mom. And once she's gone, then sometimes they never get another visit. And so having, again, somebody to care about them, you know, imagine living without having anybody care about you, you know, and so having that is a lifeline, that somebody on the outside still cares about me. I'm still of value and worth.
Mm-hmm. I was in Vermont speaking at the women's prison there, and there was a woman I met who I had not had a visitor in the 9 years she was there.
Right.
And the weekend that I was there, her dad came to visit. First visitor in 9 years. And she was traumatized because he had sexually abused her when she was a girl.
Oh,
so it's
wow.
like, well, you're getting okay. a visitor, but it doesn't really count.
Right. And women get fewer visits than men. And so, yeah.
So the need is great.
Yes, it is.
Karen, we could talk about this for the next hour. This is of great interest to me, and I appreciate your work and your research and just the mission of the Billy Graham Institute. So thank you so much for coming on the show.
Hey, well, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
You bet. 27 minutes after the hour, we'll take a short break and be back. We got Ken Kaiser coming up next, I'm told. All right, it's half past the hour. We're going to take a little news break. And then Ken Kaiser, the communications chair here at the University of Northwestern, will be in studio, I've been told. We're going to talk about all the things that are going on in Washington and elsewhere. Be back in just a minute. Minutes until the top of the hour. Are you your own worst critic? Author Kim Fredrickson says self-criticism is common, but it's not what the Bible teaches.
Mark 12:28-31, where one of the teachers of the law came and heard them debating and asked him, you know, of all the commandments, which is the most important one? And Jesus said, the most important one is this: Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength. The second is this: Love your neighbor as yourself. There is no commandment greater than these. And the whole idea is like they only asked him for one commandment, and he gave two. And the second is this: love your neighbors ourselves. So actually, our model for loving others is supposed to be how we love ourselves.
Her book is called Give Yourself a Break, Turning Your Inner Critic into a Compassionate Friend. If you want to hear that full interview, you can go to our website at myfaithradio.com, search self-compassion. Again, the author is Kim Fredrickson. I think you will enjoy that interview in its entirety. In studio is Dr. Ken Kaiser. We're going to take a short break and meet with him in just a minute.
As our culture becomes a more decadent Rome, our struggle for truth will resemble that of the early church. This is Jim Garlow. In the first three centuries of the church, Christians fought on two fronts. On the outside, they were persecuted by the pagan authorities of Imperial Rome, who forced them to confess Caesar as Lord. On the inside, it was the Gnostic wolf in sheep's clothing who claimed to be Christian but adopted the pagan spirituality of the Roman Empire. We're now seeing a repeat of this two-front battle. Our struggle for truth resembles that of the early church, as we too face those who call themselves believers in Christ but are not. After 2,000 years, the conflict over spiritual truth remains. Jesus said, I have come that they might have life and have it to the full. Only the biblical witness makes sense. Jesus is the Savior of the world. This is Jim Garlow.
Almost 20 minutes until the top of the hour. Dr. Ken Kaiser is the communications chair at the University of Northwestern. And on Wednesdays, he comes in unscripted, unrehearsed. Kent, welcome.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah. I think you know where you want to start today. The floor is yours.
Well, the big story in the news, and it actually goes into your realm of comedy.
Yes,
and so
it does.
On. So it's probably, you're probably more the expert here than I am. But this whole incident with Kathy Griffin posing for a photograph with a decapitated head of Donald Trump and bloodied head, too.
Mm-hmm.
And it's... I'm glad we're on radio, so we're not actually showing it, because I know it's showing up on television and it's a disturbing image, especially for anybody who may have seen the actual beheadings that ISIS and Al Qaeda have done over the years. You know, I can remember shortly after 9/11 and beheadings showing up online, and you could find the videos, and it's something you can't unsee. And I know some people avoided the videos, which is probably good. Personally, I saw the videos, and it's just so disturbing. It's something that stays with you, and it's just so unsettling. And to see this image of Kathy Griffin holding up the bloody decapitated head of President Trump, it kind of brought that back for me anyway. You see that image and it's just, it's too close to that terrorist act that has taken place too many times with, again, with Al-Qaeda and ISIS. And she was, of course, criticized vehemently from all sides. I mean, not just from conservatives, but from liberals. And finally, yesterday, did put out an apology statement. Now, she, up until that time, she was apparently completely unapologetic. I don't know how somebody stands there for a photograph like this. Mm-hmm. This wasn't just like some casual photograph either. This was with a professional photographer in a studio. These were like publicity kind of shots. And I don't know how somebody stands there posing for this picture and doesn't think, wow, this is just really wrong.
Yeah.
I mean, this just shows that there's no kind of morality there. This is so, it's so immoral. It's so bad. It's just inexplicable. And yet she didn't apologize until after this, of course, this picture went viral.
Yeah.
And after that, then even liberal pundits and liberal politicians and everybody in the world was basically criticizing her for it. Then she finally came up with this apology statement, which I think we have a clip of that.
And
here,
then I have a comment about her apology.
Hey, everybody, it's me, Kathy Griffin. I sincerely apologize. I am just now seeing the reaction of these images. I'm a comic. I cross the line. I move the line. Then I cross it. I went way too far. The image is too disturbing. I understand how it offends people. It wasn't funny. I get it. I've made a lot of mistakes in my career. I will continue. I ask your forgiveness. Taking down the image, going to ask the photographer to take down the image, and I beg for your forgiveness. I went too far. I made a mistake, and I was wrong.
All right, Ken, here's an observation I have. She certainly did not apologize to President Trump.
No, and it doesn't sound like she was particularly apologetic on account of something from within herself. It sounds like it was only because of all the comments on social media that she felt the need to get out there and do this video as if to sort of save her own butt in a way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, she does have a professional life in which she needs to have this image that where people want to have her on the air,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, she hosts, different shows. She hosts a show with CNN, for example, on New Year's. She hosts other things on television. She's actually upcoming. She's got a book signing actually with our U.S. Senator Al Franken here from Minnesota that's coming up in July in Beverly Hills. And yesterday, the Republican Party of Minnesota asked him to disavow and to not do that event with her. And he only came out with a statement saying that her picture was inappropriate and that she's a comic, blah, blah, blah. He didn't commit to not doing that event or anything. And so it leads one to believe that he will continue to do that event. And personally, I think people should call his office and demand that he not and express their displeasure with it. It's 651-221-1016 to call his office. 651-221-1016 to call his office and express your displeasure with him being associated with Kathy Griffin. But I think, I just think that she wouldn't have been apologetic. And so, I mean, I guess we have to forgive her. Ultimately, but one really does have to question how apologetic she is in this, because it doesn't seem like, and you're right, she didn't apologize to President Trump. And now, by the way, President Trump just minutes ago tweeted out that what she did was sick, and it's been particularly hard on his children, especially his 11-year-old son, Barron.
Mm-hmm.
And you do have to think of that. You know, it's not just the president she's attacking here. It's, you know, his family and all of his supporters, too. I mean,
mm-hmm.
That's the thing, is that a lot of these liberal elites don't kind of get, is that they're not just attacking Trump. They're attacking everybody who's a family, friend, loved one, supporter, whatever. And just think back to, like, if anyone had done anything like this during the Obama administration, it just wouldn't have happened. If they would have just been so excoriated that they wouldn't have been able to show their face in public again, and you never would have seen anybody of this prominence do anything even close to what she did with this photo shoot.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, she calls herself a member of the D-list, you know, or she had the television show my life on the D list, and she's not, you know, probably what you'd call an A-list celebrity or something, but she is very prominent, and you would not have seen anybody of even close prominence to her doing anything like that about Obama.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe she just watched Stephen Colbert, who made a horrific joke, and he paid no price except higher ratings for a few days. And that's what, you know, a comic like Kathy Griffin, I can't even call her that because I don't hear, you know, nothing she has said has made me laugh. So that's a starting point. But also this stunt obviously has cost her dearly. You reap what you sow. And I think any time you see a picture of Kathy Griffin going forward or hear that she's going to be on a show or doing a stand-up concert, you're going to think of that image. That's never going to go away.
Well, I think you and I will, and many of our listeners will think of that. I do wonder what people who are in her political camp will do. I suspect that this is going to blow over for her and that she'll continue on her merry way, making lots of money, making crude jokes. And, I mean, you know, I've never found her to be funny, but she's not one of the comedians I really follow or something.
Mm-hmm.
But... you know, this is all part of her kind of her whole method has always been to just do these stunts. I mean, that was her on her show, My Life on the D List. I mean, I never watched the show, but my understanding was that it was just one attempt after another to get publicity by whatever stunts possible in order to get herself off of the D List and onto the C or B List or whatever it was that she was trying to do. And so I think this is all just in keeping with what she's always done. And she's pushing the envelope, and she even says she moves lines and then she crosses them. And I mean, it seems like she didn't seem apologetic for that either. It seems like she would continue to do this kind of thing. So that's a little disturbing too.
Mm-hmm. Kent, we'll take a break. When we come back, we will continue our conversation or we will move on. One of the two. I just want to know if you heard Kent make reference to Al Franken's phone number. He did not read that off a page. He had that memorized. That's impressive. Be back in a minute. It is 12 minutes until the top of the hour. Bill Arnold here with Dr. Kent Kaiser in studio, which is where I like him to come versus... You've never been on the phone here.
I've never done this remotely. I've done phone interviews with the radio before. I don't prefer them. I prefer to be able to look the interviewer in the eye.
Which so. Makes me nervous. Anyway, here's an article. Physically... Oh, now it just went away. Physically... You know, these pop-up ads, you know, you're getting right to the article and you get a pop-up
right.
ad. Physically weak men more likely to be socialists.
Yeah, it's an interesting study. You know, it's something which I commented on this on social media the past week. It's a study that I really like because it has what we call a lot of face validity. And face validity is when there's something where you have a measurement of something and it just makes sense on its face. Like, you know? And this is one of those things where this person actually did a rigorous academic study where they measured, men's height, weight, overall physical strength, biceps, circumference, mm-hmm. and so on, and found that the weaker men were more likely to be socialists. And so there's only a correlation. It's not like there's a cause there. So it's not to suggest that, you know, if you're a weak man, you have to be a socialist or something, thankfully. But it's an interesting correlation. I think it confirms what a lot of us maybe see. I mean, it seems like you see these a certain type of person rallying for liberal causes, and they are physically different from those who are maybe rallying for conservative causes.
Mm-hmm.
This kind of an observation that maybe people have made. I know I have.
So this study says that if you're spending some time in the gym, you might be less of a socialist.
Well, it is kind of interesting.
It is interesting.
I mean, like I've worked out for many years at different gyms and stuff, and when you hear the conversations, you do kind of get the idea that the people who are there are not particularly liberal, you know. And maybe maybe liberals have their own gyms. I don't know. I don't think so. But it is just uncanny how this study matches up with what personally I've experienced in my own life. And again, I think that's why I would say that this study had a lot of face validity.
Mm-hmm. So there's another article, Kent, says elitism is liberalism's biggest problem.
Well, this is an interesting topic. It's come up a lot lately in the last few years, especially during the Obama administration, because we did get that sense that there was this growing divide between Americans from the center part of the country in particular and then the coasts. And it was just accentuated, I think, during the Obama administration because Obama himself was of elite schools and had sort of an elitist attitude. Remember the comments about people clinging to their guns and their Bibles from early in his first campaign. And, you know, that kind of attitude of kind of people, East Coast liberals, particularly about the rest of the country is an interesting one to observe. And now we've also got this situation where the people in the middle of the country are kind of fighting back. You know, it's like what you've seen, like we're going back to Kathy Griffin, what you see there is hate, not just for the president, but also for everybody who's a supporter of his. And that's it's just like this is, I hope, like the pinnacle of that hatred that we'd see from the liberals, you know, from the coasts versus the people who are mainly from the middle part of the country. And it is this sort of elitism. And it's very interesting to think about, like in the past, there was this sort of American elitism that was really different. It was that America was better than other countries.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember reading this one book, oh my goodness, maybe 20 years ago, called In Defense of Elitism. And it was actually written by a liberal. And this guy had been a Democrat all his life, and he defended the idea of elitism. And one of the funniest lines I can remember from the book was, he was talking about different cultures. Again, it wasn't, you know, people within the United States, but it's one culture, our culture compared to others. And he said, it's not the same thing to put a man on the moon as it is to put a bone in your nose. And it's true. It's true. There are certain cultures that are higher than others, you know, in the world. And so, you know, we had that sense of elitism. But then we moved forward into like the last 10 years, where you sort of got this sense from liberals that, no, America is just like all the other countries. And this is where some people talk about American exceptionalism and people want to say, oh, no, America isn't exceptional. But some of us say, yes, it is. Again, in comparison to other cultures. I mean, this is why everybody wants to come here and live here. And you'd go abroad and everybody wants to be in America or wants to visit America, if not live here. And that's changed because the liberal point of view is like, oh, no, America isn't any better than anyone else. And so we don't dare even talk about comparisons of America versus other countries. Now this is sort of turned inward, this elitism, like, oh, everybody should be just like those of us who are on the East or West Coast.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is, I think, the very interesting cultural phenomenon of our day, where our country has, in a sense, turned against itself. Well, you've got one big group of people on the coasts, and then you've got this other group of people, mainly in the heartland of America, who have these different cultural views, these different values,
mm-hmm.
really completely different values. And you can see the values of the liberal elites by, you know, the picture that Kathy Griffin put out yesterday with the beheaded Trump. You know, where she would think for a little bit, like, oh, it's okay to stand here in this photo shoot and do this. Stand here holding this decapitated head of the bloodied head of the president for this photo shoot, where she would think that was even okay.
Mm-hmm.
Like, can you imagine? I can't. Those of us who are here in the heartland, I suppose you'd say. I mean, for me, and I think for many others, and maybe there's a few people on the coast who agree with me. Maybe our listeners in Hartford would chime in. But, like, you know, what cultural milieu allows you to stand there and for a photo shoot and hold a decapitated, bloodied head of the president and think that's okay? That, you know, for those of us in the middle country, it makes my skin crawl to think of that. But I think it really does illustrate the difference in the cultural outlook of the people on the coast, the liberals on the coast, I should say, and the people who are in the heartland. I don't think even liberals in the heartland can accept that kind of culture that we saw yesterday with that picture that Kathy Griffin promulgated.
Mm-hmm. If you could see Kent right now, he has sweat on his upper lip.
No.
No, seriously, that... You're quite animated there,
Kent.
Yeah. So with time running out, liberals are shocked to find that conservatives are starting to hate them right back.
Well, yeah, and it's unfortunate because, I mean, you know, we should be all one country in that. But, you know, it gets to the point, and I understand it because I've been a grassroots activist all my life. And, you know, so at some point, you've had enough of things like what Kathy Griffin pulled yesterday. You have enough of... you know, being called a racist, being called names, and being called a bigot, and being actually called a hater when, in fact, you don't hate anyone. And that's what's been interesting is the liberals always want to call the conservatives the haters, but then we see something like yesterday, and it's like that really shows where the hate is coming from, and it really is from the liberal side.
And it coarsens our culture, and it makes it very uncivil. So, Kent, thanks for coming in. Always a pleasure to have you here. See you next week.
Thanks for having me on.
Yep. A couple minutes until the top of the hour. We'll be right back. Bill English is next with BibleandBusiness.com. All right. It's almost a couple minutes till the top of the hour. After the news break, we're going to talk to Bill English, who is fresh back from the Indianapolis 500. That is a sporting event where you drive for 500 miles in one day, which a lot of us can do, but we don't get to go 166 miles an hour, which in my opinion would be fun.
Thank you for listening to this conversation from Faith Radio Mornings. These podcasts are available because of listener support. You can make your gift now at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and growing the impact of Faith Radio Mornings. Also, take a moment to subscribe to this podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player and never miss a show.